Sean Carroll at Caltech says we've solved nearly all the problems of everyday life scientifically. We understand what's going on, but the rest, what a mess. Sean Carroll has just written a book on the meaning of life, Brave Man.
The statement is that we know the laws of physics underlying everyday life. So everyday life, I mean everything you see just right around you right now, everything you can touch, yourself, myself, other human beings. You know, we're made of atoms. Atoms are made of electrons, protons, and neutrons. They interact through electromagnetism, the nuclear force, and gravity. I claim that's it. I claim that that picture is correct. It is sufficient to explain what we see, unless we're a professional astronomer or particle physicist. And it will still be true 1,000 years from now. We're still going to tell that same story. Obviously, there's plenty that physicists don't understand. But I don't think that anyone believes that the reason why we don't understand hurricanes is because hurricanes are not made out of electrons and protons and neutrons. It's a matter of how those things play out in the world. And obviously, there are things we don't understand about the fundamental laws. We don't understand quantum gravity, dark matter, the origin of the universe, and so forth. But I would claim that those are not in our everyday experience. Those are outside the realms. So this is a remarkable fact that over the last 200 years, to put it generously, we've put together a picture of what we're made out of that is correct, that will last forever, I believe, unless we forget it. And it's our duty to sort of understand the complicated questions in ways that are compatible with that simple underlying description.
I could imagine someone sitting at home thinking, fine, well, you've worked out what goes on as the basis for everyday life. So, okay, we've paid for that. Now, if you want to do the rest of the stuff, find some money somewhere else, because it's nothing to do with us, baby.
They could say that, and you know they often do say that. And I would respond that it does have something to do with you, because it's human nature, it's human curiosity. The reason why we do experiments and spend money at the frontiers of physics looking for dark matter or trying to understand quantum gravity is not because we want to build a better transistor or TV set. We might. You know, you never know what kind of research is going to pay off in some sort of technological application. But the real reason we do it is because we're curious, because we want to know where the universe came from, what it's made of, things like that. I think that's the right justification. It's always going to be true.
Okay, so if you're looking at something other than the nature of everyday life, what is it? What, in fact, is your research at the moment?
Well, I'm trying to figure out where the universe came from, the very, very earliest stages of our cosmology. We talk about the Big Bang. It happened 13.7 billion years ago, but we don't know exactly what happened. You will hear people say, as if they know what they're talking about, that the Big Bang was the beginning, that talking about what happened before the Big Bang is as misplaced as talking about what's north of the North Pole. But the truth is we just don't know. And in fact, if you go into the literature, we have a whole set of different models. There could very easily have been something before the Big Bang. So I'm trying to understand how the clues we get about the universe that we do observe can help give us some guidance to figure out what happened even before the universe we observe.
We touched on that to some extent when we met last year. We wondered whether some of the work going on at the Large Hadron Collider might, when it gets going properly, and it's doing quite well at the moment, might illuminate this. How are you going in your quest?
Well, it's slow. I don't anticipate this is something where in the next year or two we'll have it all figured out. I was just at a conference at Princeton, a very small conference, 12 people, all of whom thinking about exactly this question. And at the end of the conference, we took a poll. You know, what do you believe about this and about that? No unanimity whatsoever. You know, some very basic agreements, but there's not a single question we could come up with that everyone agreed on the same answer. So, and it's certainly a long-term project, which is why I don't only work on this. I like more immediate rewards as well. The Large Hadron Collider is going to be a source of great immediate rewards. It's turned on, it's collecting data. We haven't pinned down a specific surprising result yet, but there's no doubt in my mind that in the next few years we'll be getting them.
Okay, but how are you particularly proceeding with experiments or only theoretically?
Mostly theoretically, I think, right now. When I'm thinking about the origin of the universe, there are data that are relevant, but we have those data. We have the information about what the universe was like at early times from the cosmic microwave background, for example, from primordial nucleosynthesis. So to me, we have a huge clue in the fact that the early universe was so organized, was so low entropy, was so unusual in terms of what sort of state it was in. So that is just such a statistical unlikelihood, if you plug in the numbers naively, okay, that much we can agree on. But therefore, you need to come up with some scheme that explains that. And if we had two or five different schemes that explain that successfully, experiment would have to help us choose between them. But right now we have zero schemes that explain that successfully, I would claim. So I'm thinking in very, very general terms, given what we know about gravity, particle physics, and quantum mechanics, how could we possibly imagine explaining the particular early universe we observe?
Well, there is one offering from Oxford, Sir Roger Penrose, who suggests that the universe we're seeing now is a kind of middle-aged one, which is expanding like crazy, and eventually, after an immense amount of time, everything loses mass and, you know, you get this proton soup where stuff weighs nothing and it's a kind of thinness beyond which you can. But at some stage, out of that thinness, that nothingness, comes a blip and it all starts all over again. What do you think of... Sir Roger's offering?
Well, I think Sir Roger Penrose is someone we should always listen to. I think it's a very clever idea. I'm fundamentally not convinced it's the right track for two reasons. Number one, because there is that blip where a miracle occurs. I think that he's right to take seriously the fact that we have this prediction for what the future of the universe is going to be like. The universe is going to keep expanding and accelerating. Black holes will evaporate. We'll be left with nothing. The future of the universe is empty space, and nominally it lasts forever, for an infinite number of years. And that's something that cosmologists haven't quite come to terms with yet. But then, so Roger says, well, and then something happens, and it becomes a hot big bang, which I, until a lot more details have been provided at that step, I'm not going to be too convinced. But also because the thing that I would like to explain about the universe is the arrow of time, the progression from low entropy to high entropy. And I like models where, you know, in some directions, the arrow of time arises spontaneously. And therefore, in some parts of the universe, it's pointing one way. In other parts, it's pointing another way. He has it consistent throughout the entire history of the universe. And I think that's putting in the answer rather than getting it out.
Hang on, let me just pick up this arrow of time going in one direction rather than the other. Surely it can only go forward because things change. And therefore, there's movement. When things don't change, time doesn't really register. Is that right?
Well, the arrow of time can go forward because that's how we define it. But we can imagine a universe where in parts of it there is no arrow of time. The arrow of time is really dependent on what the stuff in the universe is doing. Time is not. Let me be specific about this. Time can exist throughout the universe, but there can be parts where there's no arrow. If the universe is completely empty, there is no arrow of time. The future and the past look the same to this empty space that we're in. Therefore, when we have an arrow of time, what we mean is that matter and stuff in the universe is evolving from an organized state to a disorganized state. That's what gives the world around us its arrow.
Hence entropy.
Exactly. Entropy is just a way of quantifying this increase of disorderliness. And there's no problem at all in imagining a large-scale cosmology where what we see is a tiny bit of the whole picture. And in some parts of that large-scale cosmology, entropy is increasing in one direction of time, and in other parts, very far away, not in communication, it's increasing in the other direction.
Could that go on in the same universe like ours?
Well, it could go on in some sense in the same universe, but not in a part of the universe that we could ever communicate with. Not in a part of the universe where we're talking to them or in contact with them. Because even if you tried to imagine two parts of the universe with different arrows of time, once they start talking to each other, one of them wins. You know, one of them just takes over. So there's no consistent picture in which one person is turning eggs into omelets and the other person who is across the street is turning omelets back into eggs.
That's something of a relief. How do you link all this with the project you're working on at the moment, your next book, which is The Meaning of Life, being added to all this? How does the meaning of life fit in?
Well, I think that it's important as physicists that we take our theories seriously. And this is something where, you know, you invent a theory to explain some phenomenon that you have in your laboratory. But then our job as scientists is to believe that theory as far as we can push it. So I think that we have an understanding of how the laws of physics work in the everyday. And since we are everyday creatures, since we human beings are made of atoms, since we are governed by forces that we already know exist, electromagnetism, the nuclear force, and gravity, our vision of life and what life is needs to be compatible with that. We cannot use wishful thinking to say, well, I'm a free spirit who can overcome the laws of physics because the alternative is very disillusioning.
Do people in California try to overcome the laws of physics?
Everyone tries to overcome the laws of physics. You know, people think that they have free will, and I believe in free will, but I think that you need to be very careful about what you mean. we are not laws unto ourselves. We really are collections of particles that, in principle, you could write down the equation that says what's going to happen next. In practice, you can't. And I think that really makes all the difference. That's not just a minor footnote. The way to think about human beings needs to be compatible with the fact that we're made of particles. But that doesn't mean there's no room for us to invent concepts like beauty and morality and meaning in our lives.
How will your book differ from the one that Hawking brought out last year?
Well, I think in a lot of ways. I mean, he really wanted to emphasize in The Grand Design the multiverse idea, and in particular the idea that one underlying set of laws in physics can have many different manifestations, that the universe can look very, very different in different places. And hopefully that will help explain the particular features of the universe that we see around us. So in a sense, I'm much less ambitious. I don't want to explain the mass of the proton. I just want to explain love and brotherhood and good and evil. And that's within a framework where there are electrons, protons, and neutrons that have their properties that we know about.
I would have thought they're in such two completely separate dimensions that there's nothing that a proton or a neutron or a muon or a crouton could tell you about these higher human feelings.
I don't agree with that. For example, I think that there cannot be life after death. Why not? Well, because what particles are doing it? What forces of nature are doing it? And a lot of people will say, well, it could be some unknown forces or particles. And I think that what is not appreciated as well as it should be is that we know enough about physics to do experiments to look for hypothetical other particles and forces, and we have ruled them out. So it's always possible that we're wrong. That's always possible in science. Everything is not proved. It's always provisional. But there's absolutely no evidence that we're wrong. And so I think that, you know, just the fact that we're made of atoms tells us a lot, because whether or not we continue to exist as a spirit or a soul after our physical body disappears is a crucially important question to how we live our life.
But then there's always the get out of jail card, which says, well, laws of physics won't apply. Different deal.
Again, we could always be wrong, and there's zero evidence for it, is my point. So I like to advocate what I call the tailored suit or little black dress version of theory choice, which is that if you don't need it, then don't put it in, right? It's just Occam's razor. You want something that is tailored and comfortable, but no extra pieces of fabric that don't serve any purpose. So I look at the world, and I think that this vision that we have, this picture we put together of particles obeying forces, explains everything we see. There's no evidence against it, and therefore we should take it seriously. And of course, there could be other things that are really just perversely hiding from us, but I see no reason for it, and I think that it's just wishful thinking to think otherwise.
Sean Carroll at Caltech. His latest book is From Eternity to Here, and this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National online and Radio Australia throughout the world and the known universe.